following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. It is officially that time of the week. It's the best Tuesday you've had all week, and it's time for the True Wealth Radio Show. I am your host, David Little John, in studio with me today,
Matt Dixon.
All right, Matt.
How many tacos did you have for lunch?
No tacos.
How many are you going to have for dinner?
Probably none.
Don't disgrace a Tuesday like that. It's Taco Tuesday, David. Get on board with it.
You know what I really appreciate about you, Matt? Consistency.
Very consistent.
Since the beginning of time, yep. You have been backing the Taco Tuesday.
I love it.
Right? And just so we're clear, Matt will go and get tacos on Tuesday.
Yeah, I did.
See?
I did. Three of them.
Yeah, was it at Smokin' Fridays?
Yep, it was.
That is, you know, because that's
excellent
kind of the spot.
Yeah. How do you beat a $2 taco?
I mean, where are you with a $1 taco.
Well, then you got to get a little worried. Like, what's in this
You're
thing?
Like, wait a second here.
Is this real food?
Yeah. That's fun. So it's funny. We don't always end up doing. We go through these, like, you know, I don't know, moods, right? So we'll have tacos kind of a lot and then realize, like, we've been having tacos a lot. Let's mix it up.
I eat tacos dangerously, like dangerously high levels of tacos.
So talk to me for a second, since this is way more fun than the rest of the show. Talk to me about the taco thing. So if I were to say to you, I don't fully get the taco phenomenon.
Culturally,
people are just like, oh man, like as tacos is like the pinnacle of food. And I'm like, how do we get there?
Well, here's how.
Okay.
I like things that are easy, right? And so for breakfast in the morning, how do you have an easy meal? You scramble up two eggs, you fry up some tortilla shells on the skillet, and because of my gluten intolerance, a corn shell is an easy thing to just heat up. You cook your eggs, throw some cheese on it, throw it on the shell. You're done. You have breakfast. And at dinner time, if you need a quick meal, because I hunt and I have a lot of ground deer and antelope and elk in the freezer, you just go grab one of the little 1 pound packages, throw it in the water, defrost, cook it.
Yeah, I believed you up until you said elk.
Because you don't actually get those.
No, because elk don't exist.
Right. Yeah.
Elk only exist on preserves. I think it's actually a government conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Elk are not real.
Yeah.
People try to tell me they're real. I'm like, no, there's no elk out there. You know, there's like one elk. It's the same one. Everywhere you see it, it's always a doe. And there's no elk.
But that's why tacos are so great. They're so convenient. They're so easy. And when you go buy them, they're cheap.
So, I suppose there, but like, why not pizza, for example?
That's a good question. That is a great question because pizza actually tastes better than tacos. I don't know what to tell you.
So I'm like, tacos. Oh my gosh.
Have you ever had breakfast pizza? The co-op here in town, I don't know if they still do it, but man, back in the day, they did breakfast pizza. Oh, yeah. Instead of red sauce, you have country gravy and topped with cheese and egg and chorizo.
So
a little bit
of a secret. I cook like 95% of the breakfasts in my home.
So you have cooked a breakfast pizza?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I've done most of the breakfast stuff. Like this morning was corned beef hash, and my daughters, they like a fried egg on top of it. Heather likes some scrambled.
Would you like to know a dirty secret?
Go on.
I don't know that I've ever had corned beef hash for breakfast.
Okay. Well, you know what? That just sounds like an opportunity to me.
Well, where's my invite? Come on now.
All right. Well, come on. Noted. Now. All right. You guys all heard it on the air, but of course that does mean you got to be up early.
Yeah, okay.
So it's like, well, you're saying there's a chance.
I'm bringing
Micah. It's smaller, but okay.
I'm bringing the kid. He's going to try it out.
Hey, you know, we got plenty.
You should be terrified. He'll destroy your entire house in under an hour. Like the whole thing.
Oh, no. He's still your responsibility. That's your kid. Yeah. This, by the way, is it's the like, welcome to. Now, I had three daughters, and it turns out.
You're like, I know what a destroyed house
looks like. No. So, I mean, I know what it looks like if like a unicorn vomited everywhere, but I think little boys are like more chaotic. At least more chaotic than my daughters.
One time I tried to like just stay with him and clean behind him as he went. And I couldn't even keep up. I
was no, you can destroy way faster than you can build. Right? I mean, like, that's legit. So and so the trick will be, does he also come with the same neurotic clean streak that you have? Like, will he end up ultimately needing everything in its place, or does he completely 180 his dad?
Yes, he does. Someone gave him an electric go-kart the other day, and he was, it had a, like a bunch of grass on it, and it was dirty, and he, you could tell he was like bothered by this, and he's like trying to like clean it up a little bit. I gave him a drill with a little plastic brush on the end. He spent like an hour and a half like detail cleaning this car. I'm like, you're not even 2 years old. And, like, you've already got the bug. So, yeah, I think he's going to be a
So what we just heard here is that there's a genetic link to OCD.
Absolutely. It's there. It's there.
Okay. Well, look, on that note, so what have we established so far? Tacos are good, but we're not sure why they've been outranking pizza.
Yep.
And that you want to come over for breakfast.
Yep. Okay. That one.
Right. Okay. So glad we had that to cover. Now let's talk about things our listeners need to know. I would try to sweep it under the carpet, but I think that they'd see me do it.
Are you saying that the news is out that the stock market is
the stock market has maybe a little sniffle, right? I don't know if it's a full-blown... All right, the stock market's not happy this week.
It's under surgery.
All right. Just so everybody knows, I always joke because Matt is the younger version of an advisor, right? And so Matt was not in the profession in 2008.
That
or
is true.
2000.
That is true.
Right? And so he has not experienced like 50% market correction. So he thinks this is surgery, everybody.
This is surgery. But see, the difference is like 2008, we got the paddles out, right? Like that, they were on the, it was the crash cart.
This is surgery. This is surgery the way like, oh, I have an ingrown toenail I need to remove. That's that kind of surgery.
There you go.
Right? We're not talking about, okay.
Yeah, the market slides 8-9% surgery.
What I call that is, that's you know, kind of a rough month.
No, we're just figuring out what needs cut off, what needs to stay. That's what these tariffs feel like. Like,
and,
what do we got to trim off?
There's the key, right? There's the sneaky word he snuck in there. What's going on with the markets right now? There's always data to digest, but there's some stuff that the markets are legitimately having to contend with right now. And what is it, Matt?
Tariffs.
That,
I mean, that's one of the big pieces.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of hit. What are some of the big pieces that you think the market's really looking at right now?
I mean,
let's just throw a few out. Just brainstorm.
Like outside of tariffs?
Yeah. Well, tariffs are a big.
Or
one.
Like
some
part of like the trick? Are you saying like what are some of the trickle effects of
the
tariffs?
No, I think there's more than tariffs, right? I mean, I think tariffs are kind of spinning some of this, but. Maybe I guess it's knock-on effects of that, but it's not just. I mean, like tariffs. But like inflation is a separate issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doge is a separate issue, right? So like the entire administrative change in government,
see,
the way you approach they're independent but related issues.
How much of Doge do you think really is actually affecting the market, though? Like, is that a big player? Do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that that's really the player, unless you're like a Tesla investor. Right?
Yeah,
that's
for
really
sure.
I'm really convinced that a big portion of the pricing in Tesla is the sentiment around Elon Musk. Like, I just think that's a big driver.
Yeah, I mean, I guess outside of the tariffs, you got to look at, like, how is the actual economy doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people are seriously talking about that, like, hey, like, have we reached a point where the economy is finally slowing down? Because we had so many years of it just kind of ripping and roaring outside of COVID, right?
Well, let's do this, and let's talk about a few of the connected knock-on effects,
sure.
Just high level. So, like, because of tariffs, what?
Trade routes.
Okay, so
big
that's
one.
A biggie.
We saw a major U.S. company decide to build in Europe to just kind of try and get around the U.S.-Canada thing, right?
Okay.
So, like, we saw plans get filed to build the big factory in Europe.
Okay, so there's an example of a response, right? Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, the really big companies start putting stuff all over the place. Like, if you think about Apple, right? They are in the US, they're in China. For a while, they were really heavy in Ireland because there were favorable tax laws there back in the 20 teens, right? So those are pretty typical big corporate moves, right? And then Apple has also announced a pretty significant redevelopment back stateside. Mm-hmm. Right, I think at the tune of $500 billion or something like that. I mean, that's not small potatoes.
Just a rounding error for them.
Yeah, right. I mean, everybody's doing it. It's normal. So there's one of them. What are some other things?
I don't know. What's on your mind?
Well, the Fed and the behavior the Fed's going to have to deal with.
Yeah,
right?
Do we lower rates? Do we kind of hold steady?
Yeah, I think the Fed's really handcuffed because I don't know that tariffs are... I think tariffs are sort of inflationary in nature in the short term. And the Fed's mandate is to stabilize inflation,
right?
Which means you can't really lower rates.
I heard a theory on that, right? Because like you just said... Like, let's back it up so the listeners really catch this, right? So, inflation, if you're having inflation, which tariffs are inflationary, that's the Fed comes in, it's like, well, if there's inflation, we should up the rates, not lower the rates. And Trump keeps saying, let's lower the rates.
Yeah. To be fair, that's all Trump has ever said. I've never once heard him say that the Fed should try to stabilize the marketplace.
Right. And so you look at that and it's like, well, how could you kind of do both? Like, I think that's the question. How do you implement tariffs and get lower rates? And I think the answer is you kill the consumer, right? Like, if the consumer can't spend, right? Because, like, you kind of look at that as Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, and you're like, well, no one's buying anything. If we're going to stimulate the economy, maybe we do cut the rates. So the tariffs, if it beats the consumer down hard enough, get that effect.
This is really a cool one to unpack a little bit. So let's do that. As I look at the clock, we better grab a break. So why don't we do that? When we come back, we will kind of unpack this concept a little bit further, right? The idea of how the Fed is going to have to tango with the potential knock-on effects of these tariffs.
How are we going to do that dance, David?
Yeah, well, let's cover that. And math, that's another one.
Okay,
we got to take a break. Stick around, we'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
We got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Wow, that was a short break. I don't know about you, Matt. Welcome back to the True Wealth Show, gang. Get caught up by grabbing the podcast at littlejohnfs.com. Should be posted usually sometime tomorrow afternoon. But today we're talking about the fact that, look, the markets are just wonky this week, right? It really had kind of I know the NASDAQ, I think, had the roughest day since 2020, right? Since back when COVID was going on. It was a really off day on Monday. Just a beat down. Today did kind of bounce back a little bit. And it begs the question of, like, where are we at in the cycle? And the question is, like, how are tariffs wagging the dog on this stuff?
That's that is the grand golden goose question.
So let me ask you this, Matt. I mean, how does academically, like, if we're talking about stock prices, why is it so hard to figure out the price of a stock with these tariffs kind of float around? Like, why is the market scratching its head?
I think one of the hardest pieces in all of this is the narrative keeps getting changed day to day, right? Like, it's like, well, 25% might be 50%. Well, we might put a pause on that for the next 30 days. And then the market's like, wait, so is that an indefinite pause? And you're just, like, not really telling us that it is?
Yeah.
And so without any actual, like, clearly laid out plan, we're guessing. Every day it's just, who's going to try and guess at this thing more? And when there's a lot of guessing involved, volatility goes up. And I think that's what the drag is, because you don't want to be the last one out, do you? Right? Like, if these markets are really going to price this thing in, do you want to be the last person to have to sell off, or would you rather sell off early and just get out and be on the sidelines? And so I think we're seeing a lot of that.
Yeah. P.S. I hate both of those ideas. Right.
Yeah.
Well, only because just for everybody, we'll talk more about this later, but like you got to figure out, are you an investor or a trader?
Yeah.
Right. Because every time that you start playing the game of like, I'm going to get out of the market, and I'm going to come back in. What you're really saying is I'm going to time the market and I don't have a lot of things that are statistically reliable to do this accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And the crazy thing about the markets that in my observation has been over the last 5 to 8 years that market cycles move faster. Markets price information in more quickly. I was quite shocked during COVID in 2020 how the markets managed to go down as much as they did and then recover as quickly as they did.
Yeah, and I mean, you're talking about the investor versus the trader. That begs the question, though, how much of the market is the trader, right? Because algorithms, they've changed the way that this market works. And you got all these big institutional buyers. And so, like, there's a lot of retail investors. And yeah, for the retail investor, you got to keep your mind and your wits about this. But, you know, I think it was over $4 trillion has moved out of the market in the last 2 weeks.
Well, did it move out of the market, or did the market cap or the market valuation drop that much?
That's a good question.
Right? Because here's the weird thing. If investors should be careful about this, right? I mean, everybody, this is a great point, by the way, Matt.
Yeah.
Like, NVIDIA is a stock that's been shelled recently. Or Tesla. Tesla's maybe an even better example. It's just that Tesla's kind of wonky because of the Elon Musk entanglement and the personality entanglement there. Mm-hmm. So that's why I kind of gravitate toward NVIDIA as an example. But, you know, here's a company that is off by, what, like 30% or so off of its peak value.
Right.
That was around January. And it's kind of been sliding since then. And the question then is, well, did 30% of the shareholders in NVIDIA sell their stock?
Mm-hmm.
Or did a handful of people sell their stock and the people that were willing to sell have already sold and the only people willing to buy are at a much lower price, which means the people that want out in order to attract a buyer have
right.
to drop the price until they reach where the market's at for buyers.
Right.
So what if 95% of people are holding the stock regardless?
Right,
and all of this activity is on 5% of the trading people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the price looks like it's fallen because on paper, that's what people are willing to buy it at today.
Yeah.
But the people that are willing to buy, what are they willing to sell it at?
Mm-hmm.
And it might not, they may say, I'm going to hold this for the next 10 years. In
True.
Which case, they're just wanting to buy it really affordably.
Yeah.
And that's why I say sometimes the price can be dislocated, and we're really playing a mass psychology game in addition to the numbers, aren't we?
It's true.
And so that's the question that I have is when you get into the trader versus the investor is looking at, can I get a good cost of acquisition
mm-hmm.
and hold it until a time when I have a good cost of distribution?
Right.
Or the trader is saying, I have a finite amount of time I'm going to hold this, and I need to make a profitable move in between those two times, forward or backward.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So just a different animal. So that's the first one there. And I don't know, man. I don't know. I think it's hard for people to price this right now. I guess talking about the math, right? So
yeah.
What does a 25% tariff do to a company? Right. Let's say you're a farmer and you're growing crops. Like, what's that 25% tariff mean if you've been selling your crop overseas?
Yeah. And I think, weren't you kind of playing around with the numbers a little bit this morning on like trying to figure out like where does that actually like hit your net profitability?
Yeah, it depends on the company, right?
Right.
Like, how much do tariffs change your input costs? And those input costs change your margins. And then if you're selling, how much does it affect the amount of product you can sell because the price changes the market?
Right. So, like, did your demand start to wane?
Yeah. If you had demand destruction because pricing goes up because of the tariff impact, you can't sell as much crop.
Well, I think you have to have demand destruction, right?
In theory.
Yeah.
So now we're getting into the theory of elasticity, price elasticity. Like, if it's really inelastic, then it sells either way.
Yeah, and some stuff is like that, but a lot of stuff isn't, right?
Well, there's substitution in the marketplace.
Substitution, or you just don't buy it.
Right, which is a really extreme form of substitution, which is punt, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the bigger concern in all of this. It's like, how much are people just going to say, no, like, I'm just not going to be a buyer today?
Yeah. I think where that's going to be most notable will be...
Discretionary.
Well, definitely discretionary.
And we've already saw that priced in.
Like vehicles. I'm really concerned about the automotive industry.
Yeah, aren't I remember trucks COVID. Supposed to go up like $1,500 per vehicle in this?
Right, because
deal?
So much of the metal comes from out of the United States. And so if you put, if other countries are going to put reciprocal right. trades of 25% on the cost of all of the inputs that go into vehicles.
We just kicked around a 50% tariff on aluminum coming in from Russia, and a lot of vehicles.
It's been higher than that.
Is it?
Russia's had 100% because of that. But
and
we
how many
about
automobiles?
Canada, even like saying like, fine, we'll go after Canada and we'll make 50% on Canada. I'm like, geez, you know.
Yeah.
You know, 25%. But there's been talk about like, all right, well, if we're gonna play hardball, then we're gonna do this, right?
Yeah. And it doesn't seem like we're really backing down. I mean, I know Canada kind of backed down a little bit today. Ontario distributes a lot of the power to New York, and they were going to tariff that, and then they kind of backed off of it, and they're like, no, we'll continue to send you electricity. And at the end of the day, it's probably just because they looked at it, and they're like, well, we're just going to lose a lot of money if we actually do this. And so, yeah. Let's just keep making money.
My sense is that there's some tactics to these tariffs, and you know the issue is like it's so partisan right now. I mean, we just say like I think that Trump is not one to exhibit a lot of diplomacy in speech,
mm-hmm.
right? Let's just call it that. It's a nice way of saying Trump says mean stuff, and so like he just kind of goes right after it, and so. Like it is probably taunting Canada to say, well, you should be the 51st state. Okay, well, that's a good way to get nationalists fired up and be like, heck no, right? That's not what we're about. Sorry if you're Canadian.
Yeah.
That's not what we're about, right? So
you have to beg that question. Like, how much of this is just to push a nationalist like viewpoint where it's like, us?
Well, that was kind of the weird thing, though, is it definitely makes for a trade war, right? If the goal was to use tariffs as a way to bring people to the negotiation table to stop doing tariffs, it hasn't worked yet, right? Now, it's pretty early in the game, right? It's pretty early. But, you know, 25% tariffs are no joke. 50% tariffs are no joke. For what it's worth, personally, I think the reciprocal tariff agreement is at least on the surface, makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of trouble saying, well, it's okay if we're exporting that, you know, somebody charge us a 25% tariff, but we don't charge for the same country bringing stuff in. And I think, why is that, right? It would take some real explaining to me to get me to a point where that would make sort of sense intrinsically. So I'm like, yeah, I just don't buy it.
Yeah. That's
a
good point.
So I think I just wonder if the tariff discussion, it's one of two things. Like long term, is it really about reducing the amount of income tax that Americans pay? And if that is the case, then, you know, perhaps the economy does work more if people end up with more discretionary income because taxes go down.
Mm.
But I would suggest that it doesn't seem to intuitively work. Because about 47% of the American population is not paying federal income tax, just
right.
the way the tax code falls out right now. Or at least that was what it was a few years back. But, you know, a good portion, roughly half of the U.S. doesn't pay federal income taxes, just based on where their incomes and their exceptions come from Social Security and standard
deductions. You wonder how many jobs it's going to create, right? Like, I'm just looking up in real time, like, how do you collect on these tariffs? And man, it is a process.
Mm-hmm.
Like stuff is held in port. Like there's a bunch of forms that need to be filled out. And it is a lot of work to bring something into the country. And that's a lot of manpower, actually, to filter
through
all of this.
It's a lot of systems that haven't been created yet.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that, you know, the tech industry and the speed and processing power and coding power today is pretty radical.
That's true.
So getting systems in place is not necessarily as manual or as cumbersome as it used to be, but it's still a major overhaul of the system.
In 2023, the U.S. government collected $79 billion in tariff revenue.
Yeah.
I wonder what the projections are for 2025.
I don't know, but you got to think this way. $1 trillion is $1,000 billion.
Isn't that wild?
So that's not a lot of billions, right? You're approaching 1% of a trillion when you're at 79 billion. So like, there's nowhere that's not anywhere close to what did the IRS brought in, like 4.7 trillion.
Right.
And we're saying like, that's 79 billion. That's a lot in tariffs. I'm like, it's not even a drop in the bucket compared to the income tax revenue.
Yeah.
It's just not. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that we square our government appetite on tariffs.
Wow. They're projecting by 2026 for it to hit $271 billion.
Great. That's up to about, that's roughly 20% of a trillion.
Yeah.
Which is still, if almost, I'm mathing right, 1,600% less than the income tax.
So over triple the income compared to prior, but it's like,
but it just doesn't move the needle that much. And you hate to say, like, really, you're going from 79 billion to almost 300 billion, and that's not a big deal. No, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. But the problem is, our budget is measured in thousands of billions, right? So the U.S. economy is over 20,000 billions. Right? Like a trillion is 1,000 billions. And we're over 20 of those. That's the U.S. economy. And so you look at tax revenues of over $4 trillion. And you go, well, bringing in $400 billion is still 1%.
Yeah.
It's like, well, 1% is better than 0%, but it's not enough.
Right.
Anyway, God, we're super long on this segment. All right, enough of the tariff revenue side of things. Let's move on to, if the markets are going to be a mess, what are we going to do? But let's take this important profit break first. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Welcome back to the True Wealth Show, where I'm going to ask Matt the most important question of the day.
Seven.
All right. Well, that's the show for the day. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Right.
You're welcome.
That's like my standard answer, orange. nothing rhymes with it.
That's what I'm here for. Just what's that guy doing over there in that chair?
My question is, how, with all of this possible inflation and price change, like, how is everybody going to afford life moving forward? Like, what happens to the price of stuff? What do we think is going to shake out? Mm-hmm.
I think largely people just won't be able to afford it. And so I think you just get a bigger divergence between the lower class and the upper class. It's just the gap's going to continue to widen. The middle class will just get squeezed out.
So what's your take on this theory that the overall cost of living has still gone up the standard of living has gone up, that it's like kind of at a very all-time high on a per square foot, comfort per square foot?
I get that metric, and largely yes, right? But at the same time, I think it's actually gone backwards, because you have to gauge like overall, like, I think, kind of happiness. And look at the depression rates, right? Like, look at school shooting rates and all of it. Like, people have just come unglued, right? They're unhinged. And behaviorally, like, we're seeing people act a completely different way than I think we saw maybe in the 70s, 80s, even 90s, right? Like, to me, it just looks like the overall sentiment of the American has gone down. And so I think even though you might be living more comfortably, I don't think you're living a more happy life.
Okay. Complicated answer.
Yeah.
There's a bunch we could talk about, but
we've made things more complex, right? Like, it used to be a more simple approach to life. Like, people would listen to the radio, and yeah, they might watch a little bit of TV, but there was like four channels, and there was like a better family cohesion, I think. And what's happened is, as things have gotten more expensive, families have kind of been like pulled apart for necessity, or like to keep up with.
I think families have been kind of under fire for a while.
Yeah.
And without going into too many things that end up kind of poking the bear of controversy, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea that the U.S. economy now is essentially, it's largely built for a two working parent household.
Yep.
And that is not, it's definitely harder to maintain a family dynamic where you've got working parents and now you've got childcare dynamics and you've got all of these other things that are kind of at play.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the kids are being raised by teachers or the television or the internet a lot
right.
more than maybe their parents used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't disagree that, I mean, those are all contributing factors to happiness. So let me bring it back for a second to the initial question of, so, you know, folks seem to be generally less satisfied, but one of your points was about like the middle class itself shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of give me your take on, like I guess one, do you see a pathway for the middle class to kind of recover? And if not, then, you know,
yes.
what do you do?
I think the middle class can recover. I think it's going to be really difficult, but, you know, look at where we are spending a lot of money from a government standpoint, right? And it is in all sorts of benefits and ways to prop up with, you know, all sorts of different programs, people that are struggling. And we continue to kind of, and this sounds bad, right? Like, probably going to catch some heat for this,
right.
But
I'll take the heat.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
But it's
okay.
Like the more we fund a handout, right? Or the mm-hmm. more we make it easy to sustain on the bottom line. Like, if people can't taste poverty, right? Like, and then you hamstring the middle class by not giving any assistance there. Like, the people are by default kind of lazy, right? So they're going to gravitate towards that bottom line if it's comfortable. And so as long as that bottom tier is easy and it's sustainable and you don't starve, people are just going to settle.
Yeah, let me help you out for a minute here. I'll catch some arrows too. I've talked on the show about this, that one of the things that that we oftentimes engineer into the system, and I think it may start with good intention, but I think it's sometimes co-opted by the wrong things. And I'll give you an example, right? The concept is a pernicious incentive, okay? As an example, what happens when somebody receives more benefits for not working than for working?
Right.
Right? So if welfare or assistance payments are superior to working, then there's no incentive to leave the welfare status. Right.
Yep.
And so that's a pernicious incentive because it disincentivizes the upgrade. Right. And I think you're sort of speaking to that conceptually. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that I hear come up is the issue of, and this comes back to government spending, and it's relevant to all the different things that we're talking about in terms of purchasing and production and why the price of things gets out of whack, right? Because if you give somebody the ability to not work, then you give somebody the ability to not be in the labor force. And if they're not in the labor force, then what you're doing is you're changing the supply side of labor, which will change the price input economically. Okay, so it is an economic variable, right? They're tied it together, so I'm not just a heartless jerk when I say this. The issue is that if you've got this wrong set of incentives in place, you know, how are you going to break out of it, right? And I also worry now that we have created government agencies that's job was to manage that rather than help people to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so just like for a long time, there's been discussion about how there's a lot of political malfeasance around the military-industrial complex. I'm going to challenge everybody out there listening with a different term that can really ruffle feathers here. but it would be the homeless industrial complex.
Mm.
I think we really saw that, particularly in California, where as a progressive state, tons of money has been poured into the how to address the homelessness problem. And what they saw is the growth of agencies to address this problem, and then, surprisingly enough, a growth in the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't make the problem go away. It identified it and somehow seemed to propagate it.
Well, think about it like this. If someone's an alcoholic and you keep handing them a beer, do you think the problem's going to get better or worse?
Right. If it's like, well, they need a beer so they can be stable, so that we could talk to them about not having the next beer.
Yeah.
But we do it every time.
Right. And I feel like that's how we treat this situation, where it's just like, well, surely another handout will fix it, right? And I'm not trying to sound heartless or any of those
things. I know, it comes
things,
off that way. But all I could say is you cannot remove consequence from decisions and then expect the behaviors to change.
Yeah, you just that doesn't work.
Yeah, it just doesn't. So there we go. So yeah, not a popular one. But I want to talk about, I want to say, well, what is the pathway for the middle class? Or let's say if you're trying to break into the middle class, what do you do?
Don't have debt.
Yeah. No, the answer is you stick around until after our last break. Okay. And then when we come back, I'm going to put Matt right on the spot and say, like, give me the roadmap so that you can get into the middle class. All right.
Okay.
So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
No.
No red ink on those bills.
All right. Welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Final segment here. Right at the
you can't
right before
ask
it comes
me questions
back on.
Like that.
And then, Matt will answer the question. But you're a little bit like Ron Burgundy. Oh, he'll read whatever's on the teleprompter.
Yes.
Like, Matt.
Yeah.
So for everybody listening out here, we know tariffs and inflation, deflation, all kinds of stuff. But one thing I'm confident of is that this is a season and that the markets digest this and we move forward. And I think that it's very, very probable that this ultimately over the long term becomes a blip in a trip that the markets continue to go higher.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think the need for inflation is so strong in the economic assumptions that we'll engineer ways to get there. And right now, inflation's too high. So I'm not worried about deflation. I'm worried about inflation more long term. But it's squeezing the middle class. How does somebody either maintain status in the middle class, or let's say somebody's young, they're getting started.
Yeah.
And so if you're a parent, you got kids. Like, what's the advice that you would give to your kids as they grow up and say, this is how you're going to get to the middle class? And what would you be telling a client of yours? It's like, all right, what do I do?
Yeah. I mean, a general rule, and I mean, I'm going to exclude a house off of this most of the time, but just don't have any debt. Like, just don't do it.
Okay.
Like, don't take out a loan. I know that probably sounds radical, but often people are like, well, I'm going to go buy that vehicle and I can afford the monthly payment, so it's fine. And it's like, well, you had $10,000 sitting there. You could have bought a $4,000 vehicle and just made
it
work.
That's harder and harder, but
right.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, especially lately, right? But like, as a general rule, just don't have a bunch of debt, because when you're in debt, you're kind of just forced to make payments and exist on the fringe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So avoid debt at almost all costs. Housing, that's a little bit different.
There are calculations, by the way, to do the calculation between to rent or to buy.
Yeah.
And it's not just a financial factor. It's which one makes more sense in an area.
Yeah. I just see so many people. They're like, oh, I bought a bed and I bought it on credit and I'm making $50 a month payments for the next 3 years. And it's like, you should have probably not done that, right? Like, just as a general rule, just don't put everything on a credit card or
on depreciating assets over time is generally a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just pay a lot more for them. And so there are rare exceptions where, you may need a vehicle in rural America right now. You need a vehicle to get to work, right? And it needs to be reliable. Where most people get in trouble is they buy more vehicle than they need.
Yep. Another good one, don't buy anything at full price. Literally, find sales on things. If you just don't look at the price and you buy things, you're never going to have any money. Like, you have to be able to negotiate things. Like, if you don't have any negotiating tactics, you're kind of hosed, right? Like, you walk in to a car dealership, and they're like, well, this is the price, and you pay it, you probably lost, right? You probably could have saved thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And how long is it going to take you to earn those thousands of dollars,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, don't be afraid to really look for deals, because, like, it's hard to take that step.
I would describe this as advocating for oneself, too. I think
yeah.
that's an easy way to look at that. It's like, hey, don't be afraid to advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
Don't just take what you get. Sometimes you should be negotiating.
Like, you go to buy something on Marketplace. They want $300, offer $150. I literally have that rule. You can ask any of my friends. I always offer half of mm-hmm. whatever it is, for the most part. I even negotiated the interest rate on my house. Like, people don't realize you can do that. You can negotiate that. You don't just have to take the first offer that you're given.
Mm-hmm.
So be a good negotiator. I think that's a big piece. And a lot of people just don't like to work too, right? Like, that's a big piece in this. Like, if you want to, like, do better in life, go work at something and get some sort of skill, right? Like, it's part of how you have to get to the next step. I looked at it back when I was teaching, and I'm like, this doesn't, you know, as a growing up, I looked at teaching, and I'm like, oh, I'm totally cool just living a life that is kind of a servant's life, and just, it'll be fine. But at a certain point, I was like, I can't take the next step on this teacher salary. I got to do something different, right? And so what did I do? I transitioned into a different career, and it was a lot of work. It was studying for 9 months, mm-hmm. 6 days a week. Like, that's a lot of work.
So fun.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. It was horrible. It was the worst thing ever, but I wanted to do better, and so I put in the work to get to the next step. And a lot of people, they're just like, well, this is my skill set. I'm done. And it's like, push yourself a little bit.
Because the concept is, do you trade your time for money, or do you trade value? Right? Are you trading your value for money or your time for money? Right?
Mm-hmm.
They are actually different philosophies. And so I would just encourage everybody to think a little bit on that. You probably go out on YouTube or something and kind of get other takes on it, because I don't think we have time on the show to really unpack it today. Maybe a future episode. But the idea of upgrading your skills, if you're going to trade your time for money,
yeah.
make sure your skills are more valuable so you get paid more for your time.
And we're all, in a way, trading our time for money.
Well, like, we're definitely, yeah, the money is how you trade your time.
Yeah.
Right?
And so if you're going to spend your time, like, do it in a way that
right.
you find meaning, right? Like, don't go get a job where you're some sort of snake and you got to hate your life, but go find something where you're passionate about it and you're compensated for your time.
Yeah. I think that is probably the first step. Right. If you were to go, I think Robert Kiyosaki is an interesting guy. He's an author, by the way. If you have not read the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, it's a good framework to understand the difference between assets and liabilities and understand the progression of being an employee to having a business that sort of owns you to owning a business to being an investor. Right. And there's this pathway of growth. And the way that you get out of the middle class, the lower middle class, is to upgrade the value of your time such that you can spend less than you make. Like, if you're at the break-even point where you spend everything you make, I think you're going to be stuck on a treadmill for a long time. And anytime you get a raise, if you turn that into a lifestyle upgrade instead of a savings upgrade,
mm-hmm.
then you're unlikely to reach escape velocity.
Yeah.
Right? And so those are just some core principles underneath how you get into the middle class. Maybe said in a simple way, you have to make reasonable decisions about trading the time value of your money for the current lifestyle. So there's got to be some gratification deferral and some willingness to save and some intentionality around upgrading your skill set so that you become more valuable to the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's just how that works. And the rule's really simple, by the way. Become more valuable, even if you're not paid immediately. It will get noticed. Either where you're at, it will ultimately get noticed and come back to you, or somebody else will notice and you'll get poached away. You never hear about quality workers not having a job. If you're good at it, people will try to get you to come to work for them while you have a job.
Mm-hmm.
You're not looking, they look for you. So keep that in mind. It's something called the law of compensation. It's in another great old book right, by Napoleon Hill called Think and Grow Rich. But that concept is really pervasive. So just a handful of those. Yeah, get educated, get more valuable.
Yeah,
I like the idea of largely, you know, staying out of debt. I think consumer debt is the one I really focus on. It's like, don't buy liabilities on credit. Just not going to work out well for you.
Yeah.
So, Matt, if somebody was trying to get their save on, start building a nest egg and moving forward, and they were looking at trying to get their plan started, and they were trying to figure out where to go, and they've discovered, I think I need the right relationship in my life to sort of be a coach and a spirit guide for all of this,
mm-hmm.
and they just really like you.
Yeah.
How do they get in touch with
you? Sure. How about you shoot us a message on our website at littlejohnfs.com or just give me a ring, 541-375-0898.
Okay. And so that you text that number.
Yeah.
You can call that number. You can send us an email. And yes, you actually can reach Matt.
You can just walk into the office. I might not be available, but we're
That's
there.
Probably the single biggest challenge is that we do schedule time with our clients.
There's probably a 60% chance I won't be available, but...
Yeah, maybe higher.
Yeah.
But you could walk in and make an appointment, too, if we're not there.
So. True.
And there's more than just Matt. There's other people, too. But Matt is just so charming.
Yes.
So, anyway, as we get to the end of it, yeah, I would just encourage you guys. And if you just want to get a second opinion, if you're already working with somebody, fantastic. We're not trying to, poach. If you got a great relationship with somebody that you like and trust, take advantage. But if you do not, give us a shout at Little John Financial. Till next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM. 1240 KQEN.